there's this story about what's really going on underpinning the climate crisis. And we identified perhaps the most compelling way of making sense of this predicament as not just being a climate crisis, but being a relationship crisis.
In this episode, our guest is Jamie Bristow. He's the former director of the Mindfulness Initiative, a policy institute which was born out of the mindfulness teaching program in the British Parliament. Though he's still involved with the initiative, his main focus is now on sustainability work across various organizations. We spoke to him about his journey, the role of mindfulness in politics, and how the climate crisis is, at heart, a crisis of relationship. My name is Jeroen Jans, and welcome to the Inner Green Deal podcast. So Jamie, maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a husband, a philosopher of sorts. You know, I like to think, read, and discuss about the ways in which we can live well together as human beings, the ways in which progress happens or doesn't happen, and the ways in which we can intervene in that. And so as well as working at the Mindfulness Initiative, like I've recently taken on a role with the Inner Development Goals as a policy and advocacy lead. I teach retreats in the insight meditation tradition, and sort of altogether, I'm interested in how we can practice to be more equal to the challenges of our times, how we can develop ourselves. This is kind of a job, it's kind of a calling. It's a big part of who I am, you know, like 20 years or so of meditation and going on retreats, learning from great teachers, has made it my main hobby, and it's shaped who I am. It's shaped my mind and my heart and my personality and my preferences. I guess I'm living a calling.
It sounds from what you say that you were searching for something from a young age. Would you say that your upbringing was very aware or mindful?
I was kind of an unhappy teenager. Well, in fact, I was a very unhappy teenager at times. But I guess I came from a kind of really very comfortable, but a kind of relative spiritual poverty. And I apologize to my parents now if they listen to this, that, you know, it was a very loving, in many ways, sort of soulful environment to grow up in. But there was no religion. In fact, quite the opposite. It was kind of like militantly scientific, materialist, secular, you know, upbringing. I didn't have any sources of wisdom to try and understand how to live a happier, better life. I was a bit lost. And I kind of mined poetry and various other things for like signs of wisdom, signs of a better way of being. Wanting to improve myself, to be liked more, to be happier, became a matter of survival for me. Eventually I did come across better sources of wisdom. In fact, the first year of my university life, I came across a meditation society, and that is the kind of the beginning of my path at that point. But I put in place these routines to try and feel better, less lost, more popular, and self-improvement routines were part of my operating system. And I did what I set out to achieve, got to a point where I was feeling okay. And then I like to think I kind of overshot the mark, you know. Once these routines were in place, I became not just okay, but really quite happy. After that, I started to feel a kind of abundance that I could help other people. So that became my calling, I guess. I kind of wanted to share or further inquire into the question of collectively, individually, what are we practicing? What works? What doesn't work? How can I pass on those things that I found helpful and maybe, you know, speak about those things which are less helpful?
You were talking about self-improvement. Can you explain a little bit more about your journey towards realizing you wanted to live differently? And also how your life has changed through deeper self-awareness?
I didn't really have an explicit strategy to practice being a better person. I just sort of realized there are things about myself I wanted to change. And it happened organically. I remember the first thing was I used to drop litter on the ground, like a lot of teenagers do, I guess. But I realized that that kind of caused me a little bit of pain when I did that. And suddenly I got sensitive to the fact that that wasn't the person I wanted to be. But yet I had this habit still of doing that. I started to become aware of the moment I dropped the litter. And then I'd walk on a few paces. I'd notice that kind of dissonance, that feeling of like, that's not really who I want to be. And then little by little, I would get some more sensitive to that and then walk a few more paces and then stop and go back and pick it up and put it in the bin until eventually I think I stopped. So there's a kind of mindful, ethical inquiry that kind of went through my life from that point, which is often doing stuff which doesn't feel in alignment with the vision for yourself, how you'd like to be in the future or what you respect in other people, bringing sensitivity and awareness to the moments when you're out of alignment, out of integrity. The other things I did was just to start practicing the things that I wanted to be more like. And meditation was just an obvious fit there. I mean, it took me many years, actually, to get a meditation practice going where it was a daily thing. But I think I already intuitively got like, oh, okay, yes, I can turn inwards. And with my own will, I can shape my psyche. I can shape who I am in this moment and who I will be in future days.
So Jamie, you have worked with members of the British Parliament. We often think about the rowdy scenes that make it into the media and less about meditation. But your experience of working with politicians in the UK would suggest that mindfulness can be helpful to politicians in their daily work. How did that all come about?
So there was a member of parliament who really understood this principle of daily practice, having meditated himself for a number of years. He and a colleague decided to introduce mindfulness to his fellow politicians. Chris Ruan, a really sort of visionary politician, and now a colleague of mine, invited the Oxford Mindfulness Centre in to start providing 8-week mindfulness courses in about 2013. And on that first course, there was about 22 politicians from different political parties. Since then, I think most political parties have had some representation on the course, which has seen, I think, about 400 MPs and members of the House of Lords take part. And those initial programs were taught by Chris Cullen and Professor Mark Williams. They've since really blossomed, and there's been a weekly practice group. They have even done silent practice days, like on a Sunday, outside of the parliamentary estate. And this is, you know, pretty radical stuff. Even before you get the mindfulness or the meditation involved, you know, people from different parties who can be extremely adversarial with each other, sitting in a room with their eyes closed and sort of talking about their inner lives, the human condition, and bringing more of themselves into politics than they would otherwise. They often sort of comment on that. That they feel they bring more of their person into their profession. After a while, they became interested in how this could be better applied in society. So I was one of the volunteers and experts to come together to help them form a cross-party group, an all-party parliamentary group on mindfulness. And we conducted the first policy inquiry into how mindfulness training could be better applied in schools and hospitals, prisons, and workplaces in the public and private sectors. We published the first public policy report about this called Mindful Nation UK, and have since then been inquiring into kind of more nuanced areas, inquiring deeper into those existing policy areas, adding new ones as well, looking at mindfulness in policing or defence or how it can support older people and ageing well. We've found that the politicians over time started to realized that this wasn't just a personal benefit for them, but actually there was a wider benefit to the culture of politics, at least amongst those who had been on the mindfulness course. In the words of Tim Lawton, who's the conservative co-chair of the all-party group, he says that, you know, mindfulness has helped him to disagree better with people who he's ideologically opposed with, but it's good for all of us that they have a productive discourse rather than just a depressingly antagonistic discourse.
Can you give an example of how mindfulness has impacted interactions in the political sphere?
Chris Ruan, who started the mindfulness teaching program in Parliament, is fond of saying that he was actually one of the most disruptive members of Parliament in the debating chamber. He was quite a kind of loud heckler, and he was described by one political commentator in a national newspaper as a knuckle-dragging torturer's assistant because of his sort of demeanour and tone. He thought the opposition were sort of evil or something, certainly didn't have much sympathy for them at all. And he says that, you know, mindfulness really changed his attitude to the business of politics, what he saw as positive and productive. And he became kind of a model, really, of cross-party engagement. He was one of the most popular members in both sides of the House because he was able, I think, through practice, to see the human in those he was ideologically opposed to be able to connect at the level of human beings, even if he disagreed with them. And in fact, when we had a question on mindfulness in Prime Minister's Questions, the weekly opportunity for British politicians to ask questions of our Prime Minister, he asked about mindfulness and the Prime Minister gave a positive answer. But then the Speaker of the House of Commons said, the Right Honourable Gentleman must be a recipient of mindfulness himself. He's a much calmer and more phlegmatic fellow these days. We're very grateful to the Honourable Gentleman. And, you know, he isn't the only one. We've seen sort of changes in others. Tim Lawton, the Conservative I mentioned, also has noticed changes in his own behaviour. There was a point during a Brexit debate that he stood up, his colleagues were kind of baying for blood, like asking him to kind of stick the boot in even further. But he just stood up and just called for calm. He just said, you know, in a big loud voice, calm, waited for a couple of beats before then much, much more sensibly or you know, soberly asking his question or making his point. So there's a real opportunity for these politicians to model what it is to engage in a more productive way.
Has your work had impacts at the policy level?
So my work with the all-party group on mindfulness has been by leading this policy institute, which provides the secretariat, which clerks this all-party group for politicians. And you know, over time, we've looked at many applications of mindfulness training where the evidence base is really clear. We know that mindfulness is as effective as antidepressants to prevent people relapsing into depression, for instance. And we've got very, you know, high quality of evidence for that. And we have made recommendations to government. Many of those have been acted upon. And over time, politicians and other experts we've worked with started to see that there was a kind of bigger picture beyond these siloed applications. They're very important applications. But why is it that mindfulness and compassion are so helpful in so many different areas, from cognitive functioning like memory and attention to emotional intelligence, empathy, and leadership qualities associated with those, to, you know, resilience to psychological distress, to combating addiction, helping with the sense of sort of agency and being able to recover one's life in the criminal justice system, being able to turn a corner and live differently in the kind of personal accounts of some offenders. We started to say that, you know, that there is a bigger picture here. And in fact, you know, that bigger picture has long been part of Professor Jon Kabat-Zinn's work. The books that he's written like decades ago, talking about how mindfulness is such a sort of fundamental ingredient to flourishing mind and potentially flourishing society. He linked kind of individual and planetary health along a long time ago. But some critics would sort of dismiss that really as wishful thinking. At the same time as they would dismiss this sort of more fragmented evidence base and the applications I just mentioned as being sort of nice but the weak balm of self-improvement or like helpful in their way, but how is that really going to deliver a more sustainable, just and healthy world?
And how can it?
We saw that there was a need to kind of thread together the siloed evidence base, all these kind of points in a constellation, help to sort of see the wood from the trees, which joins up the bigger vision and the evidence base. When we started talking about mindfulness and compassion as foundational capacities, which affect basically everything we do, because everything we do, we use the mind. The mind and the heart, it shapes every interaction, every relationship. And so the most important way we talk about mindfulness is a natural human capacity that we can choose to cultivate that is foundational to our functioning. And so we set about trying to bridge this gap by creating a robust framework for understanding this fundamental foundational nature of this capacity, threading together the evidence base as rigorously, robustly as we could, and tell a narrative story. So rather than just pointing to the kind of the link between individual and planetary health, we've tried to create a narrative grounded in the evidence. This led to the creation of a document called Mindfulness Developing Agency in Urgent Times, really telling a story about mindfulness, not as a kind of chill out thing, you know, relaxation, but actually helping us to live more of the time on purpose, helping us to perceive things more clearly, helping us to understand things in a more complex, nuanced way, and to act with integrity, attuned to our inner compass, and with others well, you know. It was very, very well received. And we evolved that work to look at one problem of the world in particular, probably the biggest, most existential problem that we face, the climate crisis, which is a complex thing, interdependent with all lots of other types of crises, nature crises, a kind of political crises around the world, the kind of crisis in our sense making, in our media. All of these things are interdependent, but like the climate crisis is one that has got the world's attention, is probably the greatest near term threat. I spent the last 2.5 years or so looking at the climate crisis. We conducted a research partnership with Professor Christine Wamsler at the Lund University Center for Sustainability Studies. And together we did a wide consultation of experts and interviewed international politicians, policymakers, about what they consider to be the inner dimension of the climate crisis. We identified different narratives that were being used. Amongst them, there's this story about what's really going on, underpinning the climate crisis. And we identified perhaps the most compelling way of making sense of this predicament as not just being a climate crisis, but being a relationship crisis. And that relationship crisis is characterized by disconnection, separation. We are separated, disconnected from each other in important ways, disconnected from nature, which has huge implications for how we treat our home, and disconnected from ourselves. It was very easy for us to show how mindfulness and compassion are foundational capacities for connection, for conscious connection at each of those different levels. And so we pulled together a policy report drawing on our research, a wider evidence around mindfulness and sustainability, and published a document called Reconnection, Meeting the Climate Crisis Inside Out.
I'm very familiar with the report, which is very solid and well written, and offers really deep insights into this relationship crisis. What inspired you to write it?
I credit my mindfulness practice for inspiring me to leave my advertising position. You know, I was working in advertising and marketing, and initially volunteer for a climate change campaign before taking on a job. When I left the kind of climate change campaign world, I wanted to act. I wanted to help people to go on a similar journey, to develop greater sort of awareness and sensitivity to the state of our world and to make similar changes. That was really the beginning of the journey towards the publication, eventually, of Reconnection, Meeting the Climate Crisis Inside Out, like 12 years later. That original inspiration got me into initially working for Headspace, the app, and then supporting politicians in the all-party group. And my thinking really developed, and the sector developed. Credibility in our platform developed over the course of 10 years or so, until we were ready to look at this issue directly. Actually, the evidence base needed that time to develop as well. Like, we finally got to a point where we had something robust and credible to say. Maybe sort of 2016, we started to really develop our thinking about how mindfulness is a foundational capacity, how there's a bigger picture here, how we're missing the wood from the trees by looking at all these different siloed policy areas in health and schools and etc. Actually, there's something more profound at play, and there's a more profound potential. And that thinking, yeah, that took sort of 5 years or so until, and more broadly, until we were able to articulate this potential, and particularly the potential for meeting the climate crisis.
You've been doing this work for a long time now. What are your greatest learnings?
Yeah, it was a big jump to leave my advertising role. Till that point, I thought, you know, happiness was going to be being a chief executive of an agency and that I would live in a big house and a comfortable life. And I had to let that go, and just let go in general, I guess, and not ask what I wanted to do with my life, but ask, what does my life want to do with me? and be of service where I'm needed. And I have to say, you can't just let go all the way in one go. You have to sort of, I think, let go a little bit, trust a little bit. And then, in my experience, in the experience of many people I know who have lived beautiful lives of service, that gets rewarded by the sense of meaning and purpose and joy that comes in. And often synchronicity, things sort of fall into place when you have that kind of relationship with the world, with experience. What I've learnt between then and now, which is, I guess, since I started doing this, is to trust more and more, to let go more and more, to give myself to what the world needs of me. And tell you what, it's a double dividend. The more I did that, the happier I got. And it's just such a paradox that the more tightly you hold on to life, the more tightly you want happiness and joy, etc. And particularly when you try and get it from, you know, material things, the more elusive it is.
You spoke earlier about having a connection to the natural world. How big a role does nature play in your life?
Letting go and trusting a life of service has for me developed in parallel to really feeling part of a living world. I have a kind of loose spirituality, I guess. You might even call it mystical, in as much as I don't believe anything too concretely, and I have a kind of radical openness. A big part of that has been communing with the natural world and really breaking down the barriers between what I see as the human world or the natural world. And I moved from London to Sheffield about 5.5 years ago. Sheffield's in the north of England, just on the edge of a national park, and so I can get out into what feels relatively wild spaces you know, in quite a short drive. And it's a huge support. I don't know whether I could move back to a part of the world where I haven't got access to that. Because in a way, I feel that my constituency, the community I seek to serve, is the more than human world as well as the human world now. And so, yeah, being held by that, being nourished by that, and feeling a call to act on its behalf is a big part of what keeps me going. When I drive out to go for a walk in the Peak District, the national park near my home, I tend to check in and go, like, what would serve me now? What would help to nourish me, help me to connect? And there are different parts, different environments. There's the kind of cliff top walking where you get blown around by the elements and you just clears the mind, you know, and you have these big horizons. And that can be, yeah, beautifully clarifying and clearing out the cobwebs, you know, if you're feeling a bit dozy. And then you have like these sort of deep, sumptuous ravines with lots of trees, you know, broadleaf forests, where you can really, you know, feel close to the earth. And that kind of brings a softness, a rootedness. You have other environments which are more waterways, and there's something there about flowing or overcoming obstacles. So I haven't really thought about this before, but it's a kind of like an elemental practice. It's like, what elements do I need to bring into my being? What are kind of the analogies that I need? Do I need to flow around what feels like a stuck time? Do I need a bit more air when it's full, feeling a little bit locked down? Do I need a bit more earth when I'm feeling a bit flighty? And where are the environments that are going to bring that into my heart and mind?
Is there anything you might like to offer for people listening who are perhaps looking for a starting point to explore their calling or find a way to act?
We're conditioned by our culture and by what those close to us expect of us. It's quite difficult to break out of that, to surprise people, to be suddenly changed, and to go against the stream when our culture is telling us we need to be a certain way. And that requires really significant courage. And it might not happen all at once, and it might need to be step by step, but if I was giving advice to someone, I would say acknowledge what a big deal that can be, and focus on what gives you courage, what inspires you, and then be brave. Be different.
A lot of nourishing food for thought. And there are also recommendations in your report Jamie mentioned, which is titled Reconnection, Meeting the Climate Crisis Inside Out. You can find a link to the report in our show notes. And this episode brings the season of the Inner Green Deal podcast to a close. We'll be taking a break over the summer, but we'll be back in the autumn with a new season, a new format, and a new host. We continue exploring the inner dimension of the green and just transition. And if you enjoyed this episode, there are many others in our archive, and perhaps you might consider sharing and subscribing to the Inner Green Deal podcast or leaving a review. For now, we thank you for listening and look forward to seeing you again very soon.